Hi there, and welcome everybody to another show. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Blog Talk Radio. I'm Telly Davidson. This is the Telly Davidson Show, and we're coming to you live from beautiful downtown Manhattan this afternoon or morning, whenever you happen to be listening. And today, we have the pleasure of interviewing yet another interesting member of the book world, Larry Kane, a Philadelphia News anchor reporter who has covered in his 50-year journalism career everything from the political beat to the Beatles. And he's just come up now with his first fiction novel after about three nonfiction books called Death by Deadline, which is a mystery novel about the business he knows best, which is the news business. And he's going to be our guest today. So please welcome our featured author of the day, Larry Kane.
Hey, how are you, Telly? Great to talk to you.
Likewise. I just wanted to get into some of your background on this very new, interesting book, Death by Deadline. The plot of it, without giving it away too much, has to do with reporters who sort of both go too far and perhaps not far enough in their pursuit of the story and the tragic sort of blowback and consequences that have happened from that. Did you base this idea on any themes or stories or events that you encountered in your life as a reporter?
Well, you know, I've been an anchorman. I was an anchorman in Philadelphia for almost 40 years, and in as anchoring and broadcasting and radio and television, I guess it goes about 52 years. And yes, there were episodes in this book that are real. There are others that are totally fictional. But the story about this book is a lot different than people expect when they read it, and that's why they get a little addicted to it. The book is a mystery thriller, suspense mystery murder thriller, that takes you inside the world of local television news, without question, the world of the underworld, law, politics, racial tension, sexual tension, and all the wonderful good things and bad things, the good, bad, and the ugly, of television, local television news. This is not about network news. And basically the premise of the book, as you read this mystery and try to figure out what's happening, is that in the process of delivering the news and competing, some television stations are left naked with inexperienced people, with people who care less about being right and more about being first. So stations that would rather be first and wrong than second and right. And it's bigger than a morality story. This is a story about that will capture you from moment to moment trying to figure out what's going on. You never know who the good guys or the bad guys are. But you have three television stations in a big city, Philadelphia, and one of them is the number three station, fighting to keep its place in the world of television, which has a brave young anchor, the first female solo anchor in America. And she cares about the facts, and so do the news directors there. Then you have another station that's completely slimy and wild and doesn't really care about anybody. And this station literally, and when I say literally, kills people with its information. To give you just an example, Telly, there's a young man who's a star athlete and great student at Temple University in Philadelphia. He fits the description of a suspect wanted in the gangland murder of a gang member in the heart of Philadelphia. He comes out of a subway station one afternoon, and he's arrested for this crime as a suspect. Not booked, but arrested. He goes down to the police headquarters. They release him. He's not the guy, obviously. But the slimy station runs video of him at 4, 5, 6, and 11 o'clock. And the next day, this poor kid is murdered in cold blood because his face is broadcast all over television, even though he is not the suspect. So that's what we call death by deadline. We have Homeland Security involved. We have possible nuclear catastrophes. We've got every single scenario you can have in a murder mystery. But more than that, we have a story that is a morality play for the Times about how local news is dying. I'm sure you're from the New York area, Telly?
I'm actually from Southern California, but it's an equally large media market, and I agree with you about the death of local media.
Well, here's the issue. In the last 11 years, stations in L.A., New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, and especially smaller towns have lost 41% of their audience. Now, you can blame that on the internet. You can blame that on other sources of information, the great cable news networks. You can blame that on people being disinterested or young people watching The Daily Show or people going to what I call pocket news to get the news from their pockets and their handheld devices. So you can blame it on anything, but the direct blame goes to local television itself because it hasn't really wavered from its diet of crime. If it bleeds, it leads. That's where it's at. And as a result of that, the audience isn't interested. They're not going to local news anymore. And that's really, to me, very sad that a great industry is going away. And by the way, there are some medium and smaller markets in the nation that have already given up news. So, you know, here's a stat for you. The latest survey show that 60% of Americans get all of their news from local news. Okay? 60% of Americans. So if 60% of Americans get all their news from local news, and this becomes a real factor, and 40% of those people are not watching anymore, how many people are getting news, period, in this country?
Exactly.
We have to reinvent the wheel.
Do you think that, I wanted to ask two things on that, do you think that the people who do watch primarily local news with the eyewitness news, if it bleeds, it leads type format, do you think that they get, Michael Moore has addressed this in his documentary Bowling for Columbine, that they get sort of an over-traumatized, distorted picture of the world and of its dangers and that type of thing?
I don't know about that. I doubt that, but I will tell you this. We can't just sanitize news. You can't pasteurize or homogenize news. So if violence happens and crime happens, you have to report it. I'm not saying we shouldn't report crime, but I am saying that crime is cheap to cover. Where are the stories in local news? And this is one thing that just drives me nuts. Nuts. Local news does not cover politics. Politics is everything in our country. It's the taxes we pay. It's the schools our kids go to. It's the policies of the school boards. It's the criminal justice, the judges who are elected who send people home when they shouldn't be home, and the parole violations. Politics is our whole life. It's the Army. It's the Air Force. It's war. It's peace. And local stations do not cover politics. They'll cover, you know, ribbon cuttings, and maybe they'll run a debate at 6 o'clock in the morning. So here's what they do. They don't cover politics. This drives me nuts. And yet, they'll go out and charge the politicians a fortune to buy ads, which then define the campaigns because the local newscasts are not doing any issue coverage. I mean, that's
exactly
pathetic.
And there. Now, I did an article, actually, for my weekly column at the From Forum called Anchors Away on Katie Couric's departure and on a lot of the decline in the national news, which has seen their audience decimated also compared to what it was back in the days of Walter Cronkite and David Brinkley and John Chancellor and so forth, partly
due to the
internet.
Well, their problem is much different because basically – they are in a situation in the network news where they have direct competition based strictly on, and it really it's an important thing, they have a direct competition that's based strictly on national and international news. Okay? So as
well,
a result...
The point I'm trying to make, though, on that is I agree with you on the direct competition factor, but there a lot of their direct competition is not so much trained journalists, but it's the news personality. It's the Glenn Beck. It's the Rush Limbaugh. It's the Keith Olbermann. It's the Bill O'Reilly. It's the person who tells you how to feel about the news rather than reports the news. And
well, that's another
that
story. That's like mixing apples and oranges. MSNBC and Fox and CNN all report the news on a regular basis, and they all do a pretty good job. You know, some people may argue about Fox or MSNBC tilting one way or another, but the fact remains that in addition to the opinion shows, which are on mostly in the evening, and those are purely opinion shows, those stations do 24 hours of news. Now, The problem that
do you think the public recognizes that there's a difference, though?
No, and I think you just hit upon the most, probably the most important part of our conversation. The audience can't discern between hard news coverage and entertainment talk. Okay, so if you have Glenn Beck on, and he's doing his wild and wacky thing, he's not a newscaster. Neither is Bill O'Reilly.
But he looks and he's presented in the same format as a newscaster.
Absolutely. So
to
people
the casual
have to,
viewer.
I can't imagine. I can't think how many people come up to me and said, "Rachel Maddow said last night that," or Sean Hannity, who happens to be, by the way, one of the most thorough of those particular commentators, said to me that this happened when. And I said, but that's not news. That's an opinion show. That's a provocative show to make you think. And there's a difference. So I think people do have a hard time. I mean, there was an episode, the episode with the president's birthplace, which kept going on
and on.
And somebody, and I'm not going to say who, somebody said, well, this broadcaster on this network told me that Barack Obama was born in Kenya. And I said, well, first of all, that's highly doubtful. And secondly, which we now know is totally untrue. And secondly, he's not a newscaster. He's providing you a conspiracy theory. I mean, Mike Huckabee on the weekends is an entertainment show tilted toward a conservative audience, but he's very entertaining. So, you know, you have to draw the line. And if you can't draw the line, then you've got a real problem in deciding what's right and wrong in society.
Now, what do you think, not to get too far afield from your book, because I do want to return to that quickly, but what do you think of the fact that Donald Trump, for about 10 seconds, was up there, and you have the very strong possibility, Mike Huckabee was touted as a candidate until he bowed out, Sarah Palin is still very much in the running, and that you might have someone who has a reality TV background as the next candidate for president. Do you think that that's a plus or a minus?
It doesn't bother me. I mean, I think the American people are pretty well discerning when it comes to those kinds of issues. I think that obviously Glenn Beck's not going to run for president, and Sarah Palin is doubtful. Mike Huckabee probably would have been a pretty strong personality candidate. But really, when you think about it philosophically, it's not much difference right now between Mitt Romney and Mike Huckabee, or between John Huntsman and Mike Huckabee, or Tim Pawlenty. What you have to watch for, though, is if someone who's a demagogue, a person who cares nothing about philosophy but only about making the people fearful, becomes a candidate for president, that's a scary proposition. And we've seen pieces of that in recent elections, but no one who's really gone that far. The other thing that's interesting about Trump is that Trump is a urban citizen of New York who has been a businessman for a long time and a public figure. And I think when he was doing the birther thing, he was getting out of control. But he brought the issue up. He made people think about it, and a lot of people believed it. And that's the sort of demagoguery situation that concerns me, where somebody comes up there like they did in Rwanda, where they use the radio to demean people and debilitate people and to slaughter people. I'm not saying I don't think Donald Trump is anywhere near that. In fact, I think he's got a lot of ability to get people moving. But that didn't help him. That episode did not help him because people saw it for what it was. Americans are very discerning. I'll give you an example. 1980, okay? 1980, we have an ex-actor, two-term governor of California, running for president, all right? He turned out, whether you liked him or not, Ronald Reagan, he turned out to be a very strong president who got some things done overseas and some things done domestically. He made a lot of mistakes, too. But he had a strong cabinet, and the country felt secure with him in the office. Now, somebody could say, well, he's an actor, okay? And yet he used his communication skills, but he didn't scare the heck out of people. And he didn't divide people in a way. He was very, very calm and methodical and conversational in his outlook about conservative government. And the only reason he was able to get away with what he did was because he had this magnificent personality. Was he scary? Not. And when he ran against Jimmy Carter in 1980, there was, you know, the liberal pundits in the country were saying, well, there's no way this guy can win. They were wrong. First of all, you were dealing with Jimmy Carter.
Of course, because he was the superior communicator.
He was not only a superior communicator, but next to Carter, who looked, and I don't mean this physically, but disheveled as a leader, he actually, without question, was I would say, looked like a stronger leader. And Carter was, you know, basically perceived, and I don't know if history will perceive him this way, as a very ineffectual president. So, you know, it's really not what the philosophy is about all the time. You could have a great man who's a conservative or a great woman who's a conservative become president, and you can have a weak conservative or a weak Democrat can become president. But that we are getting off the issue here. There is some politics and death by deadline, by the way, that will stun a lot of your listeners. And, you know, it's all ebook. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Is it out right now? What is it? Does it? Is it? Could you mention the imprint or where our listeners could buy the book?
Well, first of all, it's an interesting. I've done something a little interesting. I've written 5 books. One is coming out in 2.5 years on the Beatles. I traveled with them years ago, and it's called When They Were Boys.
I was going to ask about that with your John Lennon interview.
Yeah, that's When They Were Boys, and that'll be out in 2013, and that's going to be published in print and as an electronic book. The other 3 books have all been printed in print. The book Death by Deadline is only available on the imprints of Amazon.com, Nook, iPad, and Sony Reader, and soon Google. And the book is basically it's an electronic book. And if you don't have a reader, there's an easy way to get it. You can download it. And a lot of people don't realize this. The great secret in American life is you don't need an electronic reader to read an electronic book. Did you know that?
No. Well, yes, I know it, but I want my reader, my listeners to know it, certainly.
Well, I'll tell you right now that if you basically want to read this book and you don't have an electronic reader and you don't want to read on an iPhone or a BlackBerry, which is kind of small, if you have a laptop, you can download this book from Amazon Kindle or any one of the services that you like, and it goes to your desktop after you take it out of your mail. And then you go and look for a program, a free program, called Calibre, spelled C-A-L-I-B-R-E. And you download that free to your desktop, and you then click the book, and it opens up beautifully and very physically attractive as an electronic book with all the bells and whistles. So you don't need Kindle or a Sony Reader or an iPhone or a Nook, although it might be more convenient. But I will tell you, you can read this book that way. There will be a situation in a couple of weeks, a couple of months, where this book will be available as a print-on-demand book. So you'll be able to buy it in print, but that's a little ways off. I'm doing it in the reverse. I published the book online, and I will actually print it later. So I just thought it would be an interesting thing to do, a neat thing to do. It would be kind of environmentally sound. And so far, it's the book is ranked anywhere from 3,000 to 4,000, 5,000 in Amazon books, Kindle books, which means that it's in 1%, the top 1% of all Kindle books sold in the world. So I'm pretty happy with that.
That's a great accomplishment.
I just wanted to remind
our listeners that we have a call-in number at area code 626-414-3413 if they have any comments or would like to talk to Mr. Kane for the last 10 minutes of our show. Sorry to interrupt, but go right ahead.
Do we have somebody calling?
Not yet, but we will.
Oh, okay.
But hopefully we will.
Okay, so basically, you know, that's the way I published the book. It's a real, to me, after I wrote it, and it took me 13 years to write this thing, and it's pure suspenseful fiction. After I wrote it, I read it, and I gave it to my friends and my family to read, and I realized that the book was scary. It's really scary.
And it subverts a lot of your expectations. It breaks a lot of cliches where you think it's going in one direction and it turns to another.
Well, you have to admit
there are a lot
of
double meanings.
Yeah, a lot of double meanings. I don't want to get into all of them, but, you know, there's an anchorman, for example, who goes to a friend and says, I want to kill my co-anchor. And, of course, the friend thinks he means get rid of her, you know, off the staff. But
right.
he doesn't mean that.
He means something else, yes.
He means something
now,
else.
How
yeah, go, I'm sorry.
Now, how has also writing about the news industry in fiction, when you see the news industry portrayed on Lou Grant or the Mary Tyler Moore Show, or when you see it in a movie like The Paper or All the President's Men, do you feel that it's how accurate, or I should say how inaccurate, is the public's image of what goes on in a newsroom, in a working newsroom, do you think?
I think there's a lot of times when there's a sense of, unfortunately, a sense that all these news people are glamorous and they don't know anything, and there's more credibility in newsrooms than you think. I also believe that people, I think people have a sense that, you know, that some people who are knowledgeable are not. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, and I'll say this anywhere in the country, there are a lot of attractive people on television, but it's nice to be nice, pleasant looking. But I will tell you, without question and without exaggeration, that I have never met a gorgeous person, male or female, who made it on television without a level of credibility, ever. So there are a lot of faces going places and a lot of good-looking people. But the ones, you know, if you look at the Today Show, which is one of the greatest and most solid programs in America, you have some very attractive people, but also they know what they're doing. And you know something? When they know what
right.
they're doing, that's the key. So, I mean, I don't believe a woman has to be a beauty queen to be an anchor, all right? I don't think a man has to be,
Cronkite and Ben Bradley would not have won a Mr. America contest. That's
neither
true.
Would I have. Neither would I have. And you can look me up on, if you want, on the web and see what I look like. But, I mean, truthfully, my looks have absolutely had nothing to do with my career. If they did, I would not be here sitting here and talking about this today. But I have to tell you, it was a lot of fun to write this this piece. It was hard. And
was it cathartic?
I think in some ways. I mean, I don't have to really, I don't need that. I feel good about my career. I've made some big mistakes, made some minor mistakes, had some success and some trouble along the way. And I think that when you think about this book and you read this book, almost everybody who's read it who's a news person calls me and says, boy, you really hit it. You really hit it. Now, there's some exaggerations in here, obviously. And that's what fiction's all about. But sometimes fiction can make a point. John O'Hara made his points, and John Updike made his. And sometimes fiction takes you to the far-off world, and you sort of try to realize what the real world is about. But this is a book I'm really proud of that I want a lot of people to read. I'm not in this. There's no financial edge for me in this. This is just something I wanted to do to make people understand the danger that lurks on their television sets, and not just not to believe everything they watch and hear and read, but to get the business shaped up so that 10 years from now or 15 years from now, we'll still have the same amount of newscast and we'll still have the same amount of information. And the problem is that TV stations right now are fighting for a bigger piece of a smaller pie. So, for example, I guess 2 weeks ago, one of the big stations here in Philadelphia, I was watching a primetime show, and they came on and said something along the lines of, at 11 tonight, we'll show you something that could make you bigger between the sheets.
Yes. Kelly Lang, who is also a veteran reporter in Los Angeles, who was their first female anchor woman, or one of their first, from 1971 to 2001, had a very successful second act writing mysteries, and she said that the two most valuable sweeps series, sweeps being the time when ratings are taken about 3 or 4 times a year on individual markets rather than nationally, were dating and dieting in that order. So not exactly hard-hitting political news there.
No, no. And, you know, how many skin creams are there, you know? But I,
exactly.
I know Kelly. I worked as a contemporary at a different town 3,000 miles away. And I remember when she was on the air, she was quite a pioneer in terms of being one of the strongest and most powerful anchors in the nation. And she's a great writer. I love her mystery. Hers a little different than mine, but I love her books. And I think that she, I think she's a just if you look at her in her prime and what she did in television, pretty amazing. I mean, pretty amazing.
Oh,
she was
very much.
Really,
I
one of the first.
Here.
Really, one of the first powerful, impactful female anchors in the nation, or male or female. And she worked at KABC. And she owned Los Angeles, and she was really just one heck of a personality. I don't know how she's doing. I saw her at a book fair about 5 or 6 years ago, and she's just wonderful to talk to.
Now, I met her at the Santa Barbara Writers Conference in 2004, and she is. And someone asked her about how what it was like being the first female anchor woman working on that. It was actually the KNBC lot, but the all of the shows that were going on there with, you know, Dean Martin and Laugh-In and Hollywood Squares and the pressure on her in the news division. And she talked about how super tough one had to be. She had the audience eating out of the palm of her hand with the stories that she had. Just
she was,
before
she's,
we wind up,
yeah,
we have 626-414-3413 if there are any callers out there who want to throw into the last 2 or 3 minutes of the show. But do you have any other, along with the Fab Four, super notable stories that, I mean, going through the highlight reel of your 50-year career that
well,
that
the Beatles
really,
I can talk about forever, but we don't have time for that. There was one story that I'll never forget, and that was on May 13th, 1985, and that's the day that the MOVE, the ultra militant MOVE organization, camped out in a home in West Philadelphia, where refused to move, and the mayor and the city bombed them. I'm sure you've read the story, and it was surreal. 220 homes were destroyed, 12 people were killed. It was something I'll never forget because we stayed on the air from about 7 in the morning till about 2 the next morning. And it was just an amazing event. I went to sleep, woke up, and I thought it was a dream. That story was just so extraordinarily impactful. And, of course, Three Mile Island. And you know that there's a little bit of a connection in this book to that. And Death by Deadline is not about an accident at a nuclear power plant, but there's something even worse. And, you know, it's been a good career. I've interviewed every president from LBJ on, and it's been a magnificent, I don't know if any of you, if your people know about Philadelphia, but it's just a gorgeous community to live in and a lot of wonderful people. And we have great
I was going to ask about that for our East Coast listeners. Are you doing any publicity events?
Not really with e-books, you don't do that, but I've been on, I've done quite a few broadcast events, and I plan to continue that through the summer, and then we'll get to the print edition, and we'll play with that around Christmas and the Christmas holidays, but that's about it. I am honestly, I've got to move because I'm on my way to Washington, and but I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. It's been really good.
Well, that's a two-way street, and we hope we'll have a return engagement, depending on where we all are in 2 years, when your book, and it's When They Were Boys, is
being printed by Purchase Books, by Running Press. It's going to be hot, it's going to be strong, and it's a very, 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 this is nonfiction, about a extraordinary group of boys who could have been today electricians, plumbers, attorneys, living, retired now in Liverpool, and luck and a lot of raw talent brought them to where they were. And the story of how they got there is something to behold. It really is.
And if you don't want to wait 2 years for a book by the eminent Larry Kane, you can check out his mystery thriller, Death by Deadline, which again is available in an e-book on Amazon, Nook, Kindle, and soon to be Google. Is that it?
Google and iPad.
Google and iPad, and you can download it onto your computer using, give me the name of the technology.
Well, you use first you download it if you don't have a reader, and then you get a program called Calibre, C-A-L-I-B-R-E.
Spelled British, but the D-R-E, yes.
Yes, it's the British,
okay.
But it's fantastic. In fact, it looks just looks gorgeous.
Well, I think that just about does it for the Telly Davidson Show here on Blog Talk Radio. And it was amazing having you as a guest. And we'll be back sometime soon in the ether sphere with more exciting authors and culture makers to talk about. For right now, this is Telly Davidson signing off. And have a good rest of the day.
Thanks, Telly.
Left you on the debris. That's the Sunday morning market. You were starting to the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. And that old familiar love song. Gosh, you knew you'd find me waiting there at the top of the stairs. Trouble at the depot with the General Workers Union, and yet that they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working. Left you on the debris. Now we both know you got the money, and I wonder what you would have done.